On June 22, 1970, a New Zealand man by the name of Len Demler reported his daughter, Jeanette Crewe, and her husband, Harvey Crewe, missing from the couple's home. Demler had found the house filled with blood spatter, but discovered his 18-month-old granddaughter, Rochelle, crying in her crib. The child had clearly been taken care of for at least several days at a crime scene that was estimated to be about 5 days old. The baby showed no signs of having gone without food, and there was a partial fresh bottle of milk in the refrigerator. The baby's diapers had apparently been regularly changed. Recently dirty diapers were found in the house, and the clothes dryer was still running. Neighbors reported hearing several gunshots 5 nights before the Crews were reported missing, and the baby found alive. The witnesses also described other strange occurrences in the 5 days preceding the discovery, like seeing a woman at the scene on several occasions, noticing different lights on or off around the house and farm buildings, and the curtains at the home being open and then closed. They also saw the 18-month-old child running in the yard just 2 days before being found alone in the house by her grandfather. Witnesses also claimed to have seen a woman that was not Jeanette in the Crewe car, several times traveling on nearby roads. At other times, people noticed the car parked near the road in front of the couple's house. But when authorities arrived at the scene, the family's car was in the Crewe garage. With regard to the physical evidence, although there was no sign of forced entry or a struggle, crime scene investigation revealed 2 different blood types in the house, as well as blood spatter on the porch matching one of those 2 blood types. The scene suggested that 2 people had lost extensive amounts of blood in the living room, one in a chair and the other on the floor in front of the fireplace. A pathologist noted the blood loss was enough to have resulted in the death of both victims. The seat cushion of the blood-stained chair and a rug that was normally lying in front of the hearth had been burned in the fireplace. 2 months later, in a nearby river, Jeanette's body was discovered wrapped in a bedspread bound by copper wire. Harvey's body was found upstream about a month after that, also trussed in wire, and having apparently been weighted down by a car axle. Autopsies determined both victims had been shot with a .22 caliber rifle, and Jeanette's facial bones were fractured, as were 6 of her teeth. Fragments from a lead slug were recovered from her head. The largest piece had the number 8 embossed on it. So much of Harvey's blood was on his easy chair that investigators assumed he had been shot first as he sat in the living room at a distance of just a couple of meters from the direction of the dining room. They figured Jeanette was likely hit in the face with the butt of the rifle when she tried to either defend herself or come to Harvey's aid. Then she was shot as she lay incapacitated on the floor in front of the fireplace. This was a rural farming area of New Zealand, so while police were collecting statements, they also decided to collect rifles from all the homes in the area so they could compare them with the type of gun they suspected had killed the couple. In all, they initially collected just over 60 similar weapons, and then, based on a handful of test firings, police narrowed the possible rifles in the group down to just 1, belonging to the Crewe's neighbor, Arthur Thomas. He became their prime suspect. The other initial suspect had actually been Len Demler, Jeanette Crewe's father, but he was ruled out based on the results of the rifle comparisons. Now, to back up, investigators initially did not find any ballistic evidence during several intensive searches at the crime scene, even though they had been told to look for shell casings. It wasn't until about 4 months after the crime, during their 3rd search of the yard outside the Crewe home, that investigators found a .22 cartridge case. They determined it had been shot from the rifle they had previously collected from neighbor Arthur Thomas. Later, a detective named Johnston received an anonymous tip to search Thomas's farm, where he was told he might find evidence related to the axle used to weight down Harvey Crewe's body. Johnston searched the Thomas property and found a part that matched the axle type. Arthur Thomas was then arrested in 1970 and tried and convicted in 1971 based on the cartridge casing from his gun found in the Crewe's garden and the suspicious axle piece found on his property. Despite the evidence, that his conviction led to an outcry by friends, relatives, and the media, since Thomas had no motive and was known in the community as a good man. His wife was the one suspected of being the woman who took care of the baby after the Crewe couple was murdered. Mrs. Thomas said her husband was home with her the entire night of the killings, and neither one of them had anything to do with the case. Arthur Thomas was granted a retrial, but in 1973, he was convicted for a second time. Especially following his second conviction, a variety of public and private individuals got involved in trying to get Arthur Thomas exonerated. Ultimately, the assistant editor of the Auckland Star newspaper enlisted forensic scientist Dr. Jim Sprott to re-examine the cartridge casing found at the scene. Sprott determined the case was just too uncorroded to have been outside and exposed to the elements for over 4 months. Sprott believed the evidence had been planted at the crime scene. Also supporting this theory was the fact that the area had already been exhaustively searched 2 times by police before that shell casing was found. Remember, too, police already had Thomas's rifle in their possession at the time the spent shell casing was discovered, and had already test-fired it at least once. So based on Dr. Sprott's conclusions and other statements that had come to light, a Royal Commission of Inquiry reversed Thomas's conviction in 1980 and agreed that 2 specific policemen had likely been directly involved in planning the cartridge casing. The inquiry's report stated that, quote, Mr. Hutton and Mr. Johnston planted the shell case to manufacture evidence that Mr. Thomas's rifle had been used for the killings, end quote. But the police officers were never tried because the Solicitor General claimed to have insufficient evidence. There's been much public criticism since then, suggesting that in any other country, those police would have been arrested and tried. Arthur Thomas was released from jail in December of 1979 after more than 9 years in prison. He was compensated almost $1 million New Zealand dollars. So what motive would Hutton and Johnston have to falsify evidence in the Crewe murders? You might speculate that sheer pressure to solve the crime could be enough, since you can imagine how much publicity this case got, particularly due to the baby found at the scene. But years of investigative reporting have suggested the motives of one of those officers may have run much deeper. Hutton was the police officer in charge of investigating the killings, and Officer Johnston worked under Hutton. Johnston was the guy who already allegedly got the anonymous tip to search Thomas's property for the axle part. Suspicions have continued to center on Johnston for a number of reasons and by a number of sources. Ian Wishart, author of a 2010 book about the Crewe case, paints Johnston as both the killer and the planter of the evidence, saying Johnston was actually known as, quote, the fixer or the fitter by his police colleagues because of his ability to make evidence match his version of a crime. Wishart calls Johnston a, quote, dirty cop and says he had a vindictive temper and a tendency for physical violence. Wishart's theory includes the fact that Johnston had investigated a burglary at the Crewe house in 1967, so he would have known the couple, the layout of the house, and probably even knew where they hid their spare house key. Wishart and other sources point out that in the 3 years between the 1967 burglary and the 1970 killings, there were 2 arson attempts at the Crewe farm, the first one while Jeanette was in the hospital after the birth of Rochelle. That fire was started by igniting the baby's unworn clothing. The second arson occurred precisely 1 year to the day before the killings. It's also been alleged that the brake line in Jeanette's car had been cut in 1969, shortly after the birth of the baby, but that she only told a few friends and did not contact police. There's been nothing concrete found to prove the brake incident except the word of a few of Jeanette's friends. But in hindsight, those friends seriously questioned why Jeanette would not go to the police about what had happened, unless someone from the police, specifically Officer Johnston, was involved. One suspicion is that Johnston may have been stalking Jeanette Crewe after meeting her during the burglary investigation. Jeanette was, at least in photographs, quite a beautiful woman. A second theory is that Johnston may have been trying to blackmail the couple. Since the 1967 burglary he had investigated was suspected as possibly being insurance fraud. Johnston himself admitted in court he thought the burglary was an inside job. In a book released in 2012 by Chris Burt, a reporter who's researched the case for almost four decades, it exposes more possible evidence related to the framing of Arthur Thomas and its subsequent cover-up. Burt claims that the release of previously unavailable documents has shed additional light on the truth. He insists that his are not wild theories and that he has paperwork to support all claims of injustice in his book, including the suppression of eyewitness statements and malpractice by judges, prosecuting attorneys, and other officials involved in the case. Burt purports that Officer Johnston was without a doubt the killer. However, an earlier book released by Burt in 2001 fingered Jeanette's father, Len, as the couple's murderer. So which do we believe? Now, there's one more part of the mystery that has likely crossed your mind. Who cared for baby Rochelle after her parents had been killed? There are lots of theories here, too. Initially, as I mentioned, Arthur Thomas's wife was suspected of being the woman who cared for the child after her husband supposedly killed their neighbors. Early on, some even suggested that the mystery caregiver was Jeanette Crewe herself, and that the case was a murder/suicide. Now, this theory sets forth Harvey Crewe was killed by his wife after a domestic argument in which he broke her jaw. She then took his body to the river and weighted it down, returned to the house to care for the baby, but a few days later went back to the river and shot herself. The evidence just doesn't support that at all, especially given Jeanette's body was found bound in a bedspread. Whoever was spreading that rumor could not have had the full story, which, as you know, is not often released to the public in the early stages of an investigation. Other sources continue to suggest that Jeanette's father, Len Demler, was the killer, and that her own family, either Jeanette's younger sister or her father, perhaps dressed as a woman, or Demler's new wife, one of them took care of the baby. Jeanette's mother, the first Mrs. Demler, died several months before the murders. Before dying, though, she changed her will to give half the family farm to her daughter, Jeanette, and cut Jeanette's younger sister, who was Daddy's favorite, and Mr. Demler out of the estate. But there's also lots of evidence against that theory, too, including eyewitnesses who stated the woman they saw at the house after the shootings was clearly neither Jeanette's younger sister nor her new stepmother. But if Officer Johnston was responsible for the killings, maybe he simply had somebody watching over the Crewe farm and directed that woman to care for the child until the couple was reported missing and the baby discovered. People argue, though, this act of kindness just doesn't match with a man who would kill the baby's parents in cold blood. Johnston died in 1978, less than 10 years after the crime, and before many newer forensic techniques were developed that might have shed more light on the case or found better evidence. So for now, no one knows who took care of the baby, not even Rochelle Crewe herself, who is still alive and well, unless that mysterious caregiver is still somewhere hiding the secret. In 2013, it was revealed that police have lost the fingerprint evidence from the 1970 crime scene. Now, there were said to be 10 unidentified prints recovered from the home, which can now never be reevaluated. Now, I do understand how that can happen over time. I've encountered similar situations in some of my own casework. Files get lost, they get purged, or irrevocably damaged. But it sure seems convenient in this case where one or more dirty cops seem to have gotten away with murder. Now, this lecture topic is not intended in any way to suggest that most law enforcement officers aren't trustworthy beyond measure and are not only law-upholding but also law-abiding citizens. I truly believe the vast majority are. I personally know many officers who are simultaneously incredible crime fighters and persons of great integrity. Many people say, though, there's a so-called blue wall of silence among police officers to back each other up. And sometimes wrongdoing isn't even exposed by internal affairs investigations. But it is not true that police abuse and corruption are never prosecuted. Consider the 1997 case in which Haitian immigrant Abner Louima was tortured while in custody in Brooklyn, New York. The perpetrator of the assault, a second-generation former NYPD officer named Justin Volpe, ultimately admitted guilt and was sentenced to 30 years behind bars without parole in 1999. And you can just imagine the treatment cops may get in prison from other inmates. Another officer was sentenced to 5 years as an accomplice, even though Volpe denied that man's involvement. That alleged accomplice and two other officers were originally also sentenced to 5 years each for trying to cover up the incident. But those convictions were later reversed on appeal due to a lack of evidence. That led many to argue justice was still not served in this case. The incident began during a brawl outside a New York nightclub, during which Louima was taken into police custody. At the police station, he was brutally tortured and even sodomized by Officer Volpe. Louima's teeth were broken. He suffered such serious internal injuries, he had to be taken from the precinct to a local hospital. There, Officer Volpe alleged some of the injuries were from the fight in front of the nightclub, during which the officer claimed Louima sucker punched him, although the blow was actually delivered by some other man. Later, one of Louima's hospital nurses called the authorities to report her suspicions that police were responsible for her patient's injuries. Louima ended up needing 3 major surgeries over 2 months of hospitalization. Volpe later recanted his allegation that Louima struck him, admitted torturing the man at the precinct, and pled guilty. This incident became more or less a national symbol of police brutality in the United States. In July of 2001, Abner Louima was awarded $8.75 million in damages by the NYPD. Volpe won't be eligible for release until 2025. For our final case in this lecture, we'll visit Cerro Maravilla, which is Puerto Rico's 4th highest summit. It's known as a place where you can see both the southern and northern coasts of the island on a clear day. But 2 things have really marred the area's beauty. 1, the many television, radio, and cell towers that are planted along the peak. And secondly, related to those towers, the tragic events that took place on that mountain on July 25, 1978. It was on that night that 3 young men between the ages of 18 and 24 planned to set fire to or otherwise sabotage some of the Maravilla Summit's broadcast towers. This was supposed to be in retaliation for the U.S. government's continued imprisonment of 2 groups of Puerto Rican militants. One of those groups of prisoners had attempted to assassinate President Harry Truman in 1950. And the other was a group of jailed Puerto Rican nationalists who in 1954 shot 5 members of the U.S. Congress from a balcony in the U.S. Capitol building. The 3 young men who were to carry out the tower sabotage at the top of the mountain were Carlos Soto Arrivi, Arnaldo Dario Rosado, and Alejandro Gonzalez Malave. Arrivi and Rosado were longtime members of a separatist group called the Armed Revolutionary Movement, in Spanish known as MIRA. Arrivi was from a well-to-do family. His father was famous Puerto Rican novelist Pedro Juan Soto. Rosado was from a more humble background. But both men became interested in the cause of Puerto Rican independence at young ages, probably in high school. As an organization, MIRA was founded in 1967 by Filiberto Ojeda Rios, who was credited with several acts of terroristic bombing in and around the New York area, including General Electric's corporate headquarters, a bank, and a police station. Ojeda Rios was captured in the 1970s, and as a group, MIRA is no longer active, though there are still organizations striving for Puerto Rican independence from the United States. But back to the mountain in 1978. Arrivi and Rosato met up with the third member of their sabotage group, Malave, on the evening of July 25th. The trio hijacked a taxi and ordered the driver to take them to the Maravilla broadcast towers. But when they got there, they were ambushed by waiting police. 18-year-old Arrivi and 24-year-old Rosato died that night at the top of the mountain. The police reported that they ordered the men to surrender, but the revolutionaries fired first, and two were killed in self-defense. The third man, Malave, was only slightly wounded. The taxi driver said he didn't know what had happened since he hid under the dashboard when the shooting started. But 2 days later, the cabbie changed his story during an interview by news reporters. He then said that the three men had actually tried to surrender to the officers, and that one of the men, Malave, the lone survivor of the trio, had called out to police, "Don't shoot, I'm an agent." As it turns out, Malave was a young undercover police officer, recruited while still in high school. He had been assigned to infiltrate the Mira Independence Group, to which Arrivi and Rosato belonged. Malave was the one who had told the authorities about the plan that night, and he was the one that hijacked the cab. And when the news was first released, the governor of Puerto Rico, Carlos Romero Barcelo, commended the police for preventing a terrorist attack by revolutionaries. No charges were filed against any of the police. But as the media began to circulate the taxi driver's conflicting stories, Barcelo was pressured to investigate further. The cabbie's revised and expanded version was that when he last saw Arrivi and Rosato, they were being beaten by police in front of the cab. The taxi driver said the police had extracted him from the vehicle and one of them kicked him before taking him away. Still, however, no criminal charges were filed against any of the police officers present when the two young men were killed. The opposition parties of Puerto Rico and other members of the public continued to press for justice, or at least a further investigation, saying it was a setup. Public perception was that the police executed Arrivi and Rosato to set an example for other members of MIRA. Between the years 1978 and 1980, Governor Barcelo even asked the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division to look into the matter. Both of those groups concurred with the official Puerto Rican conclusions about the case. They found that the incident was not a deliberate massacre of the freedom fighters. But in 1981, the Judiciary Committee of the Senate of Puerto Rico reopened the case, deciding to grant immunity to certain police officers who had been at the scene the night of the incident in exchange for their testimony. Although it took a couple of years, things about the events of that night on Maravilla finally began to become clearer. In 1983, Officer Miguel Cartagena Flores stated, quote, "When I arrived on the scene, I saw four police officers aiming their guns at the two activists who were kneeling before them. I turned my eyes away and heard five gunshots," end quote. Flores also told the committee that several hours before the incident, his commanding officer said to him and the other officers, quote, "These terrorists should not come down alive," meaning not survive the trip to the mountain. A second man who was also granted immunity, Officer Carmelo Cruz, corroborated those statements. Additional reports from other witnesses and the taxi driver confirmed there were two different rounds of gunfire. The cab driver said he was told by the police not to mention hearing the second set of gunshots. He also stated when he was removed from his taxi that two young men appeared to have been disarmed and were being beaten by the police. Because of these statements, it appeared to investigators that both Arrivi and Rosato were definitely still alive after the first round of gunshots and were summarily executed after being dragged from the taxi and beaten. This evidence led to the conviction of 10 police officers in 1984 on charges of perjury, obstruction of justice, and destruction of evidence. Four of the officers were also convicted of second-degree murder. All received sentences ranging from 6 to 30 years. Barcelo claimed the police involved had lied to him and that he was not involved in any type of a cover-up for their actions. While this second round of investigation between 1981 and 1984 uncovered a police plot to assassinate the victims, it could not confirm a definite cover-up by the Puerto Rican or U.S. governments, though those allegations were certainly being made. For instance, the two major Puerto Rican political parties who opposed Barceló definitely thought he and others, all the way up to United States President Jimmy Carter, were involved in a cover-up of the Cerro Maravilla massacre, as it became known. For one thing, Barceló had always aligned himself with the Republican Party. But curiously, in late 1979, while Carter was in his first and ultimately only term as president, Barceló began a Puerto Rican campaign to name President Carter as the Democratic Party nominee for the 1980 election. Carter won the nomination by a single vote. He would not have won without Puerto Rico's support. Now, Carter lost his 1980 presidential bid to a Republican, but the involvement of Barceló in Carter's campaign caused Puerto Rican opposition party members to really question whether a suspected cover-up could have even gone all the way up to the President of the U.S. and the FBI. As I said, the original United States Department of Justice's 1978-79 investigation of the Maravilla incident concurred with Barceló's conclusions, stating there was a lack of evidence to charge anyone with anything in the killings of Arrivi and Rosado. Just a month and a half after Carter won the Democratic nomination for the presidential election, the Department of Justice proclaimed the Maravilla case closed, even while investigators were still exploring, quote, unexplained contusions, in other words, bruises, seen in photos of one of the dead victims, including on Rosado's forehead just above a black eye. A bruising doesn't happen after death, but if police had beaten the young men before executing them, bruises could have been the result. In fact, the autopsy report was apparently sanitized of any mention of surface wounds, contrary to the photographs. Autopsy results further documented gunpowder residue on the chest wounds of both men that would not have occurred had they been shot at a distance. And consider the likelihood of both men being shot right in the chest if they had died in some kind of chaotic shootout with police. Much later, in 1993, a U.S. district court did consider a motion against a Puerto Rican forensic pathologist. It was alleged he altered autopsy results to make them more consistent with the police accounts of the Maravilla killings, but the allegations couldn't be proven. So even though the second round of investigations convicted 10 dirty cops and led to several suspensions, demotions, and reassignments in both police and government offices, no one was ever charged with a cover-up. The suspicions of the opposition were never satisfied, and that's why some have called the entire incident the Puerto Rican Watergate. As for Malavi, he was dismissed from the force due to public pressure, and then later also given immunity to testify against the police officers who shot Arrivi and Rosado. The police countered that even though Malavi was an undercover agent, he was the one that took the cab driver hostage at gunpoint, stating Malavi was the driver of the cab all the way up the mountain and that he refused to let the cabbie out on the road, even though Arrivi and Rosado told him that would be best. In hindsight, though, the taxi driver proved to be such a crucial witness to what really happened on the mountain that night, it's a good thing he was there and wasn't harmed. As for Malavi, he was killed on April 29, 1986, just 2 months after his acquittal in the matter. He was assassinated in front of his mother's house, shot 3 times, and his mother was wounded in the attack. A group calling themselves Volunteer Organization for the Revolution claimed responsibility and vowed to target all the police involved in the Cerro Maravilla massacre. 14 years after the incident, the man who had headed the United States Justice Department's Civil Rights Division during the investigation issued a public apology for what he thought had been a cover-up by the FBI in the case. 25 years after the killings, Former Governor Barcelo told the press it was premature of him to praise the officers involved in the incident, as he had initially done, but he still admits nothing with regard to a cover-up. Pro-independence followers still convene on the mountain every year on July 25th to mark the anniversary and celebrate the Independentista movement.